This is the operator. I do need to inform all parties that today's conference is now being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect. Thank you. You may begin.
Good morning. This is Sean Brooks, leading the next installation of the Charm Telecon. Today we are lucky to have Professor Andy Ingersoll of Caltech and Dr. Elizabeth Zibby-Turtle of the Johns Hopkins University, who will be speaking to us about the past year's discoveries at Saturn, looking at the atmosphere of Saturn, and at Titan. I'd like to give a brief introduction to both Drs. Ingersoll and Dr. Turtle, for those of you who do not know them. Andy Ingersoll is currently the Earl C. Anthony Professor of Planetary Science at Caltech. He received his PhD from Harvard in atmospheric physics, and if Andy doesn't mind my saying so, he's currently one of the preeminent planetary atmospheric scientists of the day. He's been at Caltech since the mid-60s. He also has done some stints at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. His research interests include dynamic meteorology and climatology, studying not just the atmospheres of the giant planets, but the atmospheres of Earth and a lot of the terrestrial planets as well. He's been involved in a variety of missions, such as Pioneer 10 and 11 to Jupiter and Saturn, and served as the PI on one of the instruments on that mission. He's been involved in Pioneer Venus, and the Voyager missions, the Mars Global Surveyor mission, as well as Galileo and currently Cassini, where he works with the imaging team, the Imaging Science Subsystem, ISS. And today he'll be speaking to us about Saturn weather over the past year. Dr. Elizabeth Zibby-Turtle will also be joining us. She is currently a research scientist at the Johns Hopkins University, where she's been since 2006. She received her PhD at the University of Arizona in Planetary Science and has also spent time as a research scientist at the University of Arizona and at the Planetary Science Institute. She's been involved with the Galileo mission, with the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and with Cassini. Her research interests focus on remote sensing operations and using geophysical models to interpret those observations and to understand how they express themselves on the surfaces of planets and satellites, such as examining impact cratering and how creep, for example, affects the permafrost on Mars, and she studied Io and Titan as well. So with that, I will allow Andy to kick it off and begin talking about Saturn weather 2011 to 2012.
All right. Thank you, Sean. Use the word preeminent. The way to get to be preeminent is just to hang in there for many years, and that's what I've been doing. But it's been a great ride, a lot of discoveries and even some controversies along the way. Because we're always surprised by the weather in the solar system, because it doesn't work well. It's working on the same principles, but it often doesn't manifest itself in the same way as weather on Earth. And Saturn's wild weather is a good example of that. What you're looking at in that first slide is a storm in the northern hemisphere that erupted in December of 2010 and raged for 6 months, and we're still working on the data and watching the aftermath of the storm. And it wrapped itself around the planet. You can even see the tail of the storm coming in from the left side, sort of underneath the main body of the storm. In this image, and that's a distance wrapping around the planet of 300,000 kilometers, And since Saturn is 10 times bigger than Earth, that's roughly equivalent to 10 times around the Earth. So it's a big storm. And these big storms happen, and this is very unlike our weather. They happen once every 20 or 30 years. The one before that was happened in 1990. So this intermittency, these long periods of boring weather, followed by these giant storms, and it's very vigorous storm. It's got thunder and lightning and turbulence and all sorts of stuff. Is that kind of intermittency is very different from the Earth. Now let's switch to the second slide, and you'll see that there's Jupiter and Saturn. They don't look really very much like each other, and yet Jupiter and Saturn are very similar planets in most respects that we can measure, but not in their weather. Jupiter is always churning away. It's got, as you can see in this picture, it's always got these bands, and the bands are very active. But Saturn, normally, if you can just focus on the southern hemisphere of Saturn, both hemispheres normally look like that southern hemisphere, very dull and boring. The rings cast their shadow on the planet, and that's sort of interesting for the weather. It does have a small effect on the weather to have the shadow of the rings, but mostly Saturn's weather looks like the southern hemisphere of Saturn, except for these giant storms that happen every 20 or 30 years. So one of the puzzles and challenges is to understand this difference between Jupiter's weather and Saturn's weather. They're both big balls of hydrogen gas with no solid surfaces underneath, and Saturn's getting actually less sunlight, weaker sunlight rather, than Jupiter because it's farther away. And maybe that accounts for the fact that the weather is more boring on Saturn normally. But then you have these giant storms just to make up for the long, boring periods. So I've got sort of three topics here. And the first one is what's going on at the poles of these giant planets. And the second is really lightning. And the third is the giant storm and its history and life and death and what's going on there now, and maybe some explanations which are highly speculative. So go to the third slide, which is looking down, it's looking down on the pole of Jupiter, that sort of star in the lower right is the pole, except I have to explain how this picture was made. It's actually a movie, and you can play it if you properly loaded all the files. And I don't blame you if it was a little tricky. But this movie was put together from Cassini images, but Cassini never got up over the pole of Jupiter. We flew by Jupiter, never orbited, but we flew by Jupiter in the year 2000 and took pictures of the whole planet as we went by. But the picture, our vantage point, was the equatorial plane. So that means that the pictures of the polar regions were highly foreshortened, and we didn't actually get to view the pole itself at all. But with the wonders of modern image processing, you can take these foreshortened pictures and flatten them out and project them down to get a view that would more or less approximate what it would look like if you were directly overhead, except if you have no data at all on the pole, you just fudge it. And that's what you're seeing is the fudged pole plus the region around the pole, which is rather nicely projected. So I suggest, if you can do it, play that movie. It's a wonderful thing. You can see the different bands, the different jet streams, little spots. Play it again, I suggest. Little spots going clockwise and other spots going counterclockwise. Now, actually, the whole planet, this is the North Pole, the whole planet is spinning counterclockwise, so we've projected the movie to give you the view as if you were hovering above the pole, rotating with the planet, sort of you're perched on the polar axis that's attached to the inside of Jupiter, and you're watching the currents in the atmosphere, some going east, some going west.
Excuse me, Andy. So just for everyone out there,
yeah.
You're referencing the JUP underscore pole movie.
I am indeed doing that.
Okay, great.
That is right. Now, the scale of this movie is the equator is up in the upper left corner. So you're looking, we've sort of unwrapped the planet, which used to be round. We've projected it onto a flat plane. And you're seeing everything from the equator to the pole, except you're not quite seeing the pole, as I explained. And you're seeing the multiple jet streams, some going east, some going west. And so that's, and you can, one striking thing is how active everything is, how full of turbulent jumbles and little storms bumping into each other. Now let's look at the pole of Saturn. Now, next slide is the south pole of Saturn, sort of an oblique view. There's no vertical exaggeration of this picture. If it should look to you like a little depression in the clouds, and in fact it is. The diameter of that central depression in the clouds is about 2,000 kilometers. And there's the sun is back behind the image, so there's actually you can see this sort of a shadow on the far side of this depressed hole in the clouds. So at this is the sort of ridge of clouds is at 89 degrees south latitude, which means the distance from the pole is about 1,000 kilometers. And then there are rings outside the wall of clouds on the edge of this depressed area. And in that respect, this polar ring of high clouds looks like the eye of a hurricane. And now let's move to the next slide. You can see it again from straight down, and you can see the shadows. The sun is at the 12 o'clock noon position, obliquely casting shadows, or the high clouds. There's actually two rings of high clouds, and they're both casting shadows onto the lower clouds in the center. And so in that respect, it looks like the eye of a hurricane. And we like to find analogs between planets and the Earth. And it's tempting to use the word hurricane, but let me list all the respects in which this is not a hurricane. First of all, the eye of a hurricane maybe is 10 to 100 kilometers in diameter, and this is 2,000 kilometers in diameter. So it's a very big eye of a very big hurricane. The eye wall, the clouds that ring, the high clouds that ring the center, in this case is 50 to 70 kilometers high. So these are very high, it's a very high eye wall, the clouds that ring the eye of a hurricane are maybe 15 kilometers high. So in that respect, you say, whoa, it's a super hurricane. It's got a bigger eye. It's got higher eyewall clouds. But hurricanes really depend for their life and their energy on the ocean underneath, and there's no ocean underneath these clouds. It's just the more hydrogen gas, it gets hotter and hotter as you go down. And secondly, hurricanes are really not attached to any part of the planet. They drift around the ocean and behave erratically. This thing is just locked, apparently locked to the pole, and you could argue that it's the center of all the stuff, that's all the jet streams that circle around the planet at other latitudes, and this is just the smallest one of them. So I'd say the main difference is that there's no ocean underneath. It does go round, in this case clockwise, which is the same direction that a southern hemisphere hurricane goes around on Earth. So there's some similarities and some differences, and of course that's the intriguing challenge, is to understand the similarities and differences. Okay, now, that is the southern hemisphere of Saturn. Remember, we couldn't see the northern hemisphere. We couldn't see the poles of Jupiter because we never got over the poles. We flew in the equatorial plane. But we've flown over the poles of Saturn, and I've shown you the southern hemisphere. Now it's moved to the northern hemisphere of Saturn, and you'll see a little three-step movie, I hope, with the center cut out because it was dark when we put these images together. It was dark right over the pole. It was still winter, late winter in the pole, and we couldn't image the actual center in it with visible light. But you can see a hexagon. It's a pattern in the clouds. Look at about the 4 o'clock position in this clock face, and you'll see a white spot that sort of is moving upwards and sort of curving around, following the contours of this hexagon. It's a white spot, and goes 1, 2, 3. You know, 1, 2, 3. It's a three-step movie. So, and then look. Hello, yes?
What slide are you on?
I am on slide number 6, which is it's a very clearly a hexagon in the with a big black center where we didn't have any data.
Thank you.
Yeah. So if you look carefully at this three-step movie, you'll see that the corners of the hexagon don't change their position, but that white spot and other white spots are moving relative to the corners. They're circulating around in a counterclockwise direction. That hexagon has been there since 1980 when Voyager flew by Saturn, and it's still going strong. The latitude of the corners of the hexagon is about 75 degrees north latitude. And it's a remarkable thing. This degree of permanence of the weather features on the giant planet is really very different from the Earth. We do have permanent weather features, but they're all associated with the continents and the oceans and the mountains and the difference between the continents and the oceans. But here, of course, on a giant planet, we have no continents and oceans, and still we have permanent weather features, and that's a puzzle. So I got to move on. Slide number 7 is it's a sort of a three-panel thing. The left panel is the big panel, but it's got a little white box in it. And this is Galileo image of lightning on Jupiter. The big left panel is a dayside image of the clouds on Jupiter. And then we were able with Galileo to take images of the same clouds several hours later when the clouds were in darkness. And so the little white box is a place where we took images on the night side as well. And the night side images, blown up by a factor of two, are over on the right side of this image. And so since it's dark on the night side, whatever you see are the lightning flashes. And so you're seeing lightning flashes in the little box where that little white cloud is. The exposure, let's see, the top one I think was a two-minute exposure, so it picked up a lot of noise. And the other one is a shorter, maybe less than a minute exposure. It has less noise in it. But that's all well and good, and we were happy to see lightning in the clouds of Jupiter. But clouds of Saturn are more difficult for a very strange reason. It never gets dark at night, or doesn't get really very dark at night on Saturn, because the rings are always up there shining, covering a large fraction of the night sky. If you were floating around in a balloon, you'd see the rings just covering the sky, and you could read a paper easily on the night side of Saturn. It's brighter than Earth under a full moon, simply because the rings cover such a big part of the sky. So that means that the lightning flashes, you have to pick them out in a field of puffy clouds that are illuminated by ring shine, and you have to distinguish puffy clouds illuminated from below by lightning from puffy clouds illuminated from above by ring shine. And it gets to be a little hard to decide whether the little white spots you're seeing are lightning or not. However, next slide shows some of the places that we actually finally have seen lightning. This slide is labeled down on the lower right. It says Saturn Storm Alley, and this is a band in the southern hemisphere where those little black spots. This is slide 8. Where those little black spots were giving off, first of all, they were giving off radio emissions that are called SEDs, Saturn electrostatic discharges, and they are very much like the noise on an AM radio on Earth. Not that people use AM radios very much, but in the olden days, we used to hear lightning discharges on our AM radios, so Saturn, Cassini, has a radio frequency. It basically starts at the AM band and then moves up in frequency to above higher frequencies than the AM band, and that AM radio on Cassini can detect lightning. And so every now and then, one of these storms in Storm Alley would give off some of these electrostatic discharges, which the radio receiver on Cassini would pick up. And here's a picture. This is slide number 9. If you look along the x-axis, you'll see that you go from 12 o'clock to 14 to 16 to 18 o'clock hours. So that's a six-hour period. And what's happening here is all this red stuff is the electrostatic discharges as one of these lightning storms rises on the morning side and moves across the front of the disk and then sets five and a half hours later, and then we can't hear the lightning flashes or the electrostatic discharges after it sets, and then 5.5 hours later, it comes back on the front side, and we hear them again. So this is just one half day on Saturn as we hear the radio emissions. Next slide shows that we finally got clever, and despite the fact that the clouds were illuminated by ring shine, we finally saw a little cloud here. This is a 16-minute period where we took 9 images on the night side, and the cloud was illuminated by ring shine, so we could see the cloud, but in addition to the cloud, you can see some of the images captured little lightning flashes that sort of recurred at the same positions over the 16-minute period. We even got more clever watching the giant storm. So now this is, let's see, this is slide 11, and you should see 6 pictures of the giant storm over its history, its lifetime, which spans about 8 months here. And we finally got clever enough to see lightning on the day side in the giant storm, but I'll tell you about that in a minute. The giant storm is actually visible on December 5th, 2010. I don't think this image shows it very well. It doesn't show it at all. But we were shuttering away at random, deliberately, but it was still the chance to take a picture was sort of came up at random when no one else was using the camera, basically, and the spacecraft just happened to be pointed towards Saturn, the camera had instructions, take a picture anyway. And so we were just doing that happily on December 5th, 2010. And all of a sudden, the radio receiver started telling us, we're getting lightning, we're hearing lightning. And one of these random opportunities to take a picture just came up. We didn't control it from Earth. It had been planned 6 months in advance. And there was a little dot. And the dot grew, and over the next few weeks, it spread out and finally became this giant storm that wrapped itself around the planet, as you can see here. The commanding of the Cassini spacecraft is all done. The plan is all put together months in advance, so we couldn't change our imaging sequence. But the amateurs, now if you look at slide 12, these are pictures taken by amateur astronomers, Anthony Wesley in Australia and Christopher Goh in the Philippines. They have beautiful techniques, they take beautiful images nowadays and are very helpful to the professional astronomers with their cumbersome long-range plans. And so the amateurs kept track of this storm as it grew. You can see Anthony Wesley's picture shows a growing storm on December 14th. It still looks rather small, actually, at that time. But it grew, and the amateurs kept track of it. Slide 13 shows a close-up that Cassini finally took in, January. And this is, you'll notice that the colors are rather garish. But the upper panel is actually, the left of the upper two panels is shows the little place that's outlined in white in the middle long strip, and then the right side shows the part that's outlined in white in the middle long strip as well. And the colors here are, we use special filters to indicate the height of the clouds. So where you see very bright yellow or white, those are high, thick clouds. And where you see red, it's a cloud, but it's very deep with no clouds above it. And where you see blue, you're seeing a high cloud. So we can tell which are the high clouds. A high thin cloud that is sort of semi-transparent, whereas the yellow is a high thick cloud, very much like a big thunderstorm. So we're having fun with that. I think I'll skip because I've been too long-winded. There's a picture of Jupiter's Great Red Spot. That's slide 14. But it's just an illustration of how we use these special filters to measure the heights of the clouds. The Great Red Spot is a high cloud as well. Next one is slide 15, which shows 10 separate images of Saturn while the giant storm was going on in January 2011. And you can see a big bright spot. This is measuring the temperature of the stratosphere in infrared images. And these infrared images are responding to pretty high up in the atmosphere where the pressure is just 1 millibar. That's 0.1% of the sea level pressure on Earth and 0.1% of the clouds, the pressure at the cloud, the main clouds that we see in visible light on Saturn. So this is the stratosphere, and somehow this giant storm heated up the stratosphere by a huge amount, 50 degrees Kelvin or Celsius. And we don't fully understand that it must have been the result of waves that propagated up through the atmosphere into the stratosphere and then deposited their energy up there. But the mechanism of generating these waves, I guess violent convection could do it, violent thunderstorms. Okay, now let's move on to slide 16, which shows what happened to the storm. So you see a bunch of strips, and they're dated. And the strip dated 2010-1205, that's the discovery image, and there's a little, this is exaggerated color, so you can actually see the little first day of the storm, and it looks like a little red dot in the 2010-1205 image. And then now, the head of the storm is afterward marked with a red triangle after that. But the storm also spun off a blue circulating oval, which is marked with a black triangle in the subsequent images. And they spread apart. The red triangle is the head of the storm moving to the west, and the black triangle is the spinning oval moving west more slowly, so that they were spreading apart. And then look down to 2011-05-05. That's May 5th, 2011. And you can see that now this the blue oval, which is marked with a black triangle, is coming in from the left side and is getting closer to the head of the storm. And then on 2011-6-14, it's very close. And it looks like they're going to collide. And indeed, they did collide. And then the last strip at the bottom, 2011-7-12, they collided and the head of the storm disappeared. And that was the end of the storm. It left this wake of turbulence, but we never saw the head after that. And the next slide is slide 17. It maybe is a little complicated, but it just shows how we tracked in longitude. That's the x-axis here, and time runs down the vertical axis. We tracked ahead in the storm, and when they collided, that's the blue arrow, that's when it all ended. The slide after that, slide 18, shows what the radio noise from the storm did. And you can see that on July 1st, the radio noise had sort of gone away, and it continued intermittently after that, but it really marked the end of the storm. So you could say the storm ended when the tail came and ate the head, the tail coming around from the other side ate the head. And we did see lightning in the storm. Slide 19 is pictured with little cartoon lightning bolts of where we detected the lightning. On the day side, we're getting clever on detecting lightning on the day side, even though the lightning flashes are not much brighter than the normal clouds. The way we detect them is to subtract images. So if you look at slide 20, you'll see these are two images taken through a blue filter that were taken 10 minutes apart, and we subtracted one from the other. And if nothing had happened, nothing at all, you'd get just speckly noise. If something moves, it'll turn white on one side and black on the other, and that there's sort of a oval spot up in the upper left that has done exactly that. And also, if a lightning flash occurs in one of the images but not in the other, you'll get a white dot, and that right in the center of this image is the lightning flash. So we had to work hard to detect them, but there they are. By exaggerating the color, if you look at slide 21, we exaggerated the color, and in this case, we saw the lightning flash in a blue-filtered image, and so what you're seeing here is a exaggerated color, which shows the entire head of the storm on the left side and then a little portion on the right side. And if you compare the portion on the right side with the portion on the left, there's a little blue dot there because we exaggerated the colors, and it just shows up. So I think we'll stop there, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Great, Andy. Thank you very much. So if there are any questions out there, I'd like anyone who has one to step forward and fire away. Okay, well, I think I may go ahead and ask a few questions of you, Andy, if you don't mind. One thing, when I think about storms on the Earth, I mean, I think that, at their heart, what they essentially are energy imbalances in the atmosphere. So regarding the hurricane, I mean, is it possible that this is somehow just the outermost expression of some sort of internal cold spot somehow, or what's the inherent energy imbalance going on there? Do you have any sense for that?
No, that's a good question. You first of all have to have a source of energy, and in the case of the Earth's hurricanes, it's a warm tropical ocean that's been sitting in the sun for the whole summer season, and it warms up, and that represents energy, which can be released when it loads the atmosphere above with moisture. And it's possible that there's an analogous thing going on the giant planets, because these things are still cooling off. They have internal energy, that's left over from the formation, and that internal energy is coming out. What we don't understand quite is why it comes out either on Saturn intermittently every 20 or 30 years, or why you get this hurricane-like behavior right at the poles of Saturn. So there's lots of details, but the basic energy could be rather similar.
Well, one thing that I find kind of fascinating is that you get this sort of range of behaviors. You know, Jupiter is pretty much always stormy, lots of small ovals and things like that. And Saturn, for the most part, is quiescent until, boom, bam, you get this big thing popping up.
I'm working very hard with my colleagues to figure that out. And we have some theories, but we're not ready to go live with the theories.
We will certainly look forward to hearing them when you are ready. Regarding the lightning flashes, were you looking a little more closely during the equinox period when the rings would have been edge onto the sun and wouldn't have played such an obstacle in helping you find them?
Absolutely, yes. In fact, that was the first way we saw the lightning was during equinox or within a week or two of equinox. We had asked permission to take a lot of pictures during that time when the night side of the planet was dark, and indeed that's when we first saw lightning on Saturn in the with the camera. We got cleverer. Basically, if you think about it, a lightning flash is there for a very short time. So if you take a very short exposure picture, if there's lightning there, it'll be just as bright as if you'd taken a long exposure picture. So a short exposure picture it makes the background clouds fainter, and the lightning remains just as bright as it always was because it's a very short event. And so taking a lot of short exposure pictures is the secret to detecting the lightning, and that enabled us to detect the lightning on the day side of the planet. But we hadn't figured that out, so our first lightning efforts were during equinox.
All right, and I know you've got to run in a moment, so if anyone else has any questions, now would be the time to get them out.
So the big storm is apparently upwelling from deeper levels. Did it let you learn anything about the composition of deeper levels in the atmosphere?
Yes, indeed. It dredged up a lot of stuff, pumped a lot of stuff into the stratosphere, and really, we're learning about the chemistry that goes on in the stratosphere and in the troposphere, for that matter. The basic molecule that contains carbon is methane, and there's plenty of methane in Saturn's atmosphere, and plenty of hydrogen, for that matter. So a lot of the interesting chemistry involves what you get when you start reacting methane with or hitting it with sunlight. And so you get acetylene and ethane and some of these multi-carbon atoms. And there's been a lot of interesting repercussions in the chemistry due to this rapid upwelling and downwelling, for that matter, associated with the storm.
Is there any water to speak of?
There is water. Well, we are pretty sure that the lightning is occurring in the water cloud, but the water cloud is covered up by clouds that are higher up in the atmosphere, made of ammonia and a combination of hydrogen sulfide and ammonia. And those clouds occur higher in the atmosphere, up to 100 or 200 kilometers higher than the water cloud. And so we don't actually see the water itself. We see the lightning. The fact that the lightning covers, they look like blobs 200 kilometers in diameter because the photons are diffusing up from deeper levels. That 200 kilometer width of the light when it finally emerges from the tops of the clouds is really telling us that the lightning bolts are 200 kilometers down below the tops of the clouds. That gives them a chance to, the photons a chance to spread out. So we kind of know with a lot of uncertainty, but we kind of know how deep the lightning is, and it's 200 kilometers down below the tops of the clouds, and that really puts it in the water cloud. So we have indirect evidence of the water cloud being there, but we don't actually see the water because it's the only thing we can see is the lightning.
Hey, this is Kevin Koski, Solar System Ambassador. A bolt of lightning or whatever you want to call it on Saturn, what size would it be, like a third of the Earth, a quarter, an eighth? Something to give a comparison to.
The lightning is, you know, is just a single flash. The light spreads out, and so 200 kilometers would be 10 times bigger than a thunderstorm on Earth. But that's just a single lightning flash. The head of the storm in the image, in the last image here, slide 22, the head of the storm has a diameter of 10,000 kilometers. So it's the size of the Earth. The Earth would cover up the head of the storm, but not much more than cover it up. So, I mean, you got to remember Saturn is 10 times bigger than the Earth. So you could put the Earth down there, and it would cover up the head of the storm. But the whole tail, you'd need, I don't know, you'd need 20 Earths to cover up the whole storm.
All right. Good enough, yeah, because it would be just kind of interesting, you know, to be able to get a comparison to that. Storm like that would be Earth size, or, you know, it would take 20 to cover the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Actually, maybe 40. To wrap around, I'm just doing the math here. To wrap around the planet, I think it'd be 40 Earths.
Oh, wow.
For up that storm.
That's unfathomable almost.
I got to check my math. I can't do the math over the telephone.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, though.
Yeah.
Okay, so with that, I think I'd like to thank you, Andy. We probably should get moving along. And next, we're going to have Dr. Zibi Turtle from Johns Hopkins, who is deeply mired in some really engrossing and very exciting science at Titan. So, Zibi.
Thank you. I work with the Cassini mission and associate of both the ISS teams and the radar teams, and am, as Sean said, primarily focused on studying Titan, as well as other icy satellites, but Titan's been the major focus. So I'm pleased to get to summarize some of the results from Titan over the last year or so. The second slide in the package I put together just shows an overview of the Cassini mission with the different the years. It's hard to believe we're into the ninth year of this mission. It's spectacular to get such a long data set, and you'll see why in some of the upcoming slides. But this shows a number of orbits around Saturn in each year of the mission at Saturn, and then the number of flybys of the different satellites. You can see Titan, Enceladus, and the other icy satellites as well. you'll notice that there tend to be more flybys of Titan than the other satellites. That's just because Titan is the only really big satellite, and therefore the one that's used consistently to change Cassini's orbit around Saturn, for example. We're moving into a higher inclination orbit phase now, where we get better vantage points for studying, for example, the poles of Saturn and also the rings and the magnetic field as well. So Titan is used for that. The other reason for so many flybys of Titan is that Titan is exceedingly complicated and hard to understand. And although we've been there for, been in orbit around Saturn for 9 years now, or 8 years, I guess, but into the ninth year, and have had a lot of flybys of Titan. We've had 85 flybys on which date it was taken of Titan. There's still a lot we don't understand, but we're learning more and more each time, and I'll be talking about some of the things we've learned in the last year. The third slide has a list of the flybys that have occurred in the last year. The next flyby of Titan, T86, is actually tomorrow, and I'll talk about that flyby in particular a little more at the end of the presentation. The fourth slide shows the most recent map of Titan. This is actually released just under a year ago and includes data through April of 2011, but it gives a good overview of our view of the surface. So far, you can see there are actually some gaps. We've seen all of the surface at low resolution, but at these higher resolutions or moderate resolutions, there are still some gaps in our coverage, and we're still working to fill that. The orbit of Cassini's orbit doesn't always give us a view of every part of Titan on every flyby, and so it takes time to fill that in. But this is a good overview of Titan with the dark material you can see at the equator. The equator is generally arid, and the dark material there is primarily hydrocarbon sand that forms giant dune seas. And at the high latitudes, you can see there's also dark material, and in those areas we've learned that the dark material is actually hydrocarbon liquids forming seas at the North Pole and many lakes at the North Pole and some lakes at the South Pole as well. So one of the things that this long-term mission has afforded us is an opportunity to really look at seasonal changes in the Saturnian system. And the fifth slide just lists dates in the Titan year of various events. So the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 flybys back in the early 80s were in late March, early April in Titan's year, which time period we have just passed. So it's been just over a Saturnian year since the Voyager flybys. Cassini arrived in the equivalent of mid-January in Saturn or Titan's year, and 5 years later, we had the northern vernal equinox. So now we're moving into early spring or mid-spring, actually, at this point. There was a large storm observed at low latitudes 2 years ago now, a very, very large storm seemed to bring quite a lot of rain to the low latitudes, which are primarily arid. But as we know, by Earth's deserts, you can also get rain once in a while in the desert, and on Titan it seems that this happens maybe during the equinox. We haven't seen any large storm activity. In fact, we've barely seen any clouds since then, actually, which is very, very interesting. And we're waiting to watch to see if the weather activity moves into the northern hemisphere now that it's getting into late or mid-spring in the northern hemisphere. So right now, it's basically late April, almost getting into May on Titan. The current plan with Cassini, if everything goes well and resources hold up, is to continue the mission through the northern summer solstice, which is actually not for a few years yet. So it would be an absolutely spectacular data set regarding the seasonal changes in the system. So the next slides talk about some of the changes we've actually seen on Titan as a result of the change in season. The sixth slide shows some observations of the detached haze layer. If you look at the left, the images on the left, you can see these are very high phase angle images of Titan. You can see that there's actually a, you can see the bright limb of Titan, and then there's a gap, and then there's another bright layer. That's the detached haze layer. This is very, very high altitude. When Voyager was there, which, as I said, was in the kind of March-April time frame, the haze layer was lower. When Cassini got there, the haze layer was much higher, up at about 500 kilometers above the surface. So something had clearly changed, and what we've been able to watch as the Cassini mission has gone on is the height of the detached haze layer decrease at equinox quite rapidly. So you can see on the graph on the right, this is from a paper by Bob West et al. From last year, you can see the diamonds illustrate the height of the detached haze layer as viewed by the Cassini imaging system. And that's pretty consistently at about 500 kilometers altitude. And then right around equinox, it just drops. And this is consistent. The little triangle there, you see at about 360 kilometers, about 500 days after equinox on the x-axis, is a Voyager measurement. So you can see that it's kind of dropped down from the high altitude during the late southern summer. And now that we're past equinox, it's similar to what was observed by Voyager. And this gives us some constraints on the processes that may be causing the haze and the changes in the altitude of the haze. So this is one of the things that we'll be also very interested to watch as we progress toward northern summer to see how the altitude evolves. The next slide is a series of images of the North Pole of Titan. Early in the mission, a North Polar ethane cloud, a very high-altitude cloud that appears to be composed of ethane. These are observations by the VIMS instrument, the Visual and Infrared Mapping Spectrometer, in a paper by Lumuelic et al. Early on, this very extensive North Polar cloud of ethane was seen. And as the mission goes on, you can see steps through time in each of these images, and the seventh and then eighth slide, the eighth slide shows them all projected looking down on the pole. You can see that this ethane cloud has dissipated as the seasons have progressed on Titan and as the North Pole is coming into illumination. So this also gives us information about the circulation of the of Titan's atmosphere and how that changes with the seasons. Moving to the southern hemisphere, which is just going into darkness now, now that we're past the southern autumnal equinox, the South Pole is less and less illuminated. There's less and less energy to drive activity there. It's cooling down. Some of the most recent observations have shown on the right side, there's an observation by VIMS that illustrates hazes forming in the high altitude and high southern latitudes. The winter pole typically has a hood of haze on Titan, and so this is what we saw at the North Pole on Titan when Cassini arrived. But now we're watching that form at the South Pole. The slide on the right, and there's a movie of this as well. I put the link in. I didn't actually do the linking within the PowerPoint, but you can go to the website and click on the link there. There's a short time step, a short movie of several time steps showing the rotation of the observation on the left hand of this side, left hand side of this slide. Which is an ISS observation, an imaging observation of a vortex that's been observed forming over the South Pole. So this is lower down in the atmosphere, and there seems to be convective activity in the atmosphere and behavior in this vortex forming as the South Polar atmosphere cools down. And you can see, if you look at the movie, you can see the motion within the vortex. The vortex itself is rotating, but you can see motion within the vortex as well, which is what's consistent with convective cells. So moving beneath the clouds, beneath the atmosphere, down this is slide 10. We've also had observations of Titan surface, not only with the VIMS and ISS instruments, but also with the radar on Cassini. And there's a strip here, synthetic aperture radar strip of the surface of Titan. This is northwestern Xanadu, and you can see these long dark streaks. Those are longitudinal dunes formed of the dark hydrocarbon material I mentioned earlier. And on the right-hand, upper right-hand corner of the image, you can actually see an impact crater. This is the crater itself is 29 kilometers in diameter. This is the Ksaw crater. Titan is actually, in many ways, very similar to Earth, despite the fact that it is the materials and the conditions are very different, much colder. A lot of the processes are very similar. And Titan has very few impact craters, just like the Earth, comparatively to what you'd expect. If you look at the Moon, you see our Moon, you see a lot of impact craters because the Moon is an ancient surface, whereas the Earth's surface is consistently being eroded and modified by geologic processes. We see something very similar in Titan. There are very few impact craters, and that is indicative of a relatively young surface age. Certainly on Titan, we know that erosion is playing a very large role from the atmosphere. Aeolian erosion, which is consistent with the fact that we see all these dunes. There's clearly a lot of wind activity driving the geology in the surface. And as I mentioned earlier, there's also precipitation, rain from the atmosphere eroding the surface as well. But this is one of the few impact craters we have observed on Titan. And a particularly nice example. And you can see how the dunes kind of run up to the ejecta blanket and then wrap around or stop at the ejecta blanket. The 11th slide shows the results of a study by Legall et al. Of the dunes and how they vary with latitude. The ISS map I showed at the beginning, the dunes are all really concentrated in the low latitudes, plus or minus 30 degrees of the equator. But within that, there are some variations. So on the left, the top image is of dunes in Belette, which is a very large, extensive sand sea, the largest sand sea on Titan. And the lower slide is dunes in Fensal, which is further, which is closer to the edge of the equatorial band of dunes. And you can see some striking differences here. The in the Belette dunes, you can see bright and dark striping through the dunes. In this case, a lot of that bright dark striping is actually due to the illumination of the surface. These are both radar images, and slopes facing the radar are brighter than slopes facing away from the radar. But the entire surface of Belette, and if you go back to the ISS map, you can see the entire surface of Belette is dark. Whereas in Fensal, what you're seeing is dark dunes. Again, the dune material itself is dark. The sand is dark hydrocarbon material. But then you see brighter areas in between it. And the radar can actually penetrate a little bit into the surface. So because it at least to dry surfaces, so surfaces of the composition on Titan that are dry. So at this wavelength, the radar can penetrate a little bit through, and what we're seeing here is the dark dunes, and then you see through a thin layer of sand, or perhaps no sand, in between the dunes. So there's a difference in the style of the dunes. We see the same thing on Earth, and these are compared on the right to dunes in Oman and dunes in the Kalahari. And the big difference is the availability of sand to form the dunes. So in Belet on Titan and Oman on Earth, there is a very large supply. There's no shortage of sand to form the dunes. And so there's a lot of material in between the dunes as well as in the dunes themselves. In Fensal or the Kalahari on Earth, there's less material to form the dunes, and the dunes are narrower. There's much less material in between them. So what this suggests is that the areas to the north on Titan, the areas of that equatorial band that are further north, actually seem to have less material to form the dunes. This is also the case if you go up in altitude. So the dunes that seem to be at higher altitude on Titan, we don't have as good topography maps of Titan as we do on the Earth, but the topography information we do have suggests that the dunes at higher altitude also have less material. So this suggests that there's more material available to form dunes at lower altitude on Titan and at southern latitudes instead of northern latitudes. Now, this is consistent with some other observations of Titan. Saturn's orbit is slightly around the Sun is somewhat eccentric. So Titan's southern summers are shorter but warmer than the northern summers, and this may in the current epoch at least, and this may explain not only why there's more material south of the equator to form dunes, because if the southern summers are drier, then hotter, then they may be then the area to the south is more likely to be drier. The south is more likely to be drier than the northern hemisphere. This is also consistent with the fact that there are many fewer lakes and only smaller lakes seen at the South Pole in the current epoch. All of the big seas on Titan are at the North Pole, and there are myriad lakes as well. The South Pole has several lakes, but just not nearly the same number. So, again, this is consistent with a drier southern hemisphere currently and a wetter northern hemisphere. The 12th slide also talks a little bit about the lakes. A recently published comparison of Ontario Lacus, which is one of the southern lakes on Titan, with Earth's Etosha salt pan, and some of the morphology of the shoreline is consistent. Also, some work done earlier by Alex Hayes demonstrated that the boundary of Ontario may actually be receding a bit, that Ontario may be shrinking as the seasons progress. So it's possible, or the interpretation by Cornet et al., is that Ontario is generally shallow and may be shrinking or continue to shrink as the Titanian year progresses. Another recently published paper, I should say this is work, this is a work ongoing to understand Ontario Lacus better, and there's still a lot of questions about this lake and whether the shoreline is receding, and we hope to get a few more observations before the sun sets completely on the southern hemisphere for Titan's winter, or Titan's southern winter. There's also another recent paper suggesting that there may be some low-latitude oases near Shangri-La, which is one of the one of the low-latitude features, albedo features. Griffith et al. Have detected areas that may have, or they interpreted as having liquid on the surface at low latitude, which is particularly intriguing given that this is generally seems to be an arid part of Titan. Longitudinal dunes take a very long time to form, and so overall the climate at the low latitudes needs to have been dry. But that doesn't, as I said earlier, need to always be dry. And in fact, Huygens, when it landed, did detect methane moisture in the soil. So there may be some moisture remaining at low latitudes. There's also some recent work with multiple lines of evidence from the SEERS instrument, the composite infrared spectrometer on Cassini, as well as the ion and neutral mass spectrometer on Cassini, and the Huygens gas chromatograph mass spectrometer, all of which suggest, based on the isotopic ratios of methane or of carbon in the methane, that the methane on Titan and Titan's atmosphere has to be, can't have been there more than a billion years. Methane escapes from the top of Titan's atmosphere. It's broken down by methane. I shouldn't say that. That's an oversimplification. Methane is broken down by ultraviolet light into and hydrogen can escape, and the other parts of the molecule recombine to form higher order hydrocarbons, and this is what forms the hazes and the complex hydrocarbon chemistry on Titan. Because of this escape process, the lifetime of methane in Titan's atmosphere is limited. Understanding how long Titan's atmosphere can have been the way it is now is important to understanding Titan's history overall. These lines of evidence demonstrate that it has to be relatively recent, and in fact, some of the lower limits are down at the 10 or 100 million year timescale for the methane in Titan's atmosphere, which of course brings up the question of where it's coming from and whether this is a very special time in Titan's history or whether there's methane in within Titan that gets resupplied to the atmosphere, and that's an ongoing study that is of particular interest for understanding Titan and its methane cycle. Stepping further into Titan, on the 13th slide, shows a couple of graphics illustrating the internal structure of Titan. There's some manuscripts that have been published in the past year by Fortes and by AS et al. Discussing the moment of inertia of Titan and observations of the height of the tide observed on Titan as it rotates around Saturn. And there's a link here to a movie that shows an exaggerated animation of, and this is also, sorry, the movie is also linked on the CHARM website. It's an animation exaggerating the tidal stretching of Titan as it rotates around Saturn. The moment of inertia of any body, Titan in this case, gives information about how the material is distributed within the body. And the moment of inertia of Titan is consistent with a differentiated interior, i.e. an interior that has a denser core than the outer shells. Graphic here illustrates the hydrosilicate core, and then over that there are ice shells and likely a global subsurface ocean. And the evidence for the subsurface ocean comes, since water ice and water do not vary dramatically in density, the moment of inertia, the gravity data can't distinguish the presence of an ocean. However, looking at the tides of the body, how the body deforms as it goes around Saturn, can. If Titan were solid, if it were solid ice, the tide should be about a meter high. But the tides observed are about 10 meters, and that is consistent with a decoupled ice shell on top of a global ocean. It doesn't constrain the thickness of the ocean. The ocean doesn't have to be very thick. It doesn't have to be very deep. It can be deep. But the top ice shell has to be decoupled from the interior in order for these 10-meter tides to be observed. So that adds to the evidence that Titan does have a global ocean, most likely water, perhaps mixed with some ammonia. Titan's shape is also, the paper cited at the bottom by Chacroun and Sautin, Titan's shape is somewhat flattened. It's not a perfect sphere. No, very, very few bodies in the solar system are. Anything that's rotating is going to be likely to be a little wider, depending on the specific conditions, but usually the equator is bigger than the polar radius. The equatorial radius is bigger than the polar radius for any body that's spinning. And that is true for Titan. However, it's actually more flattened than you'd expect based on its current rotation rate. It had been hypothesized early that this was due to the fact that Titan had a faster rotation period in the past, and that that was, or that shape was locked in. You can see this at Iapetus. Iapetus is one of the best examples of this. The shape of Iapetus is actually consistent with a much faster rotation rate. Iapetus, being very distant from Saturn but still tidally locked, has a very long period, I think it's about 70 days. And so it really shouldn't show much flattening, much oblateness due to its rotation at all. But it actually has an oblateness that's consistent with a 17-hour rotation period, which suggests that this may have frozen in very early in Iapetus history when it had a faster rotation rate. So that's one of it's one of the theories for why Titan is why Titan's shape is the way it is. But another hypothesis published this year is that it's actually due to the weather cycle and the carbon cycle. If Titan at the poles, for example, I showed earlier that ethane cloud, the evidence of the ethane cloud from the visual and infrared mapping spectrometer. If there's ethane rain at the poles, which is predicted that ethane is precipitating out, if it's precipitating out at the poles preferentially, then it may saturate the surface at the poles. And being denser than methane, it may actually the polar regions may actually subside a little bit because of that. We actually see this in places on Earth. You can get areas that are that are saturated with water that actually subside. And so that may also explain this phenomenon. It would depend on, for example, the latitude over which ethane rain occurs compared to methane rain, and how well ethane replaces methane in the crust. And there are a lot of outstanding questions about the carbon cycle, and especially the hydrologic cycle in Titan, and how well connected aquifers, or methanophers, if you prefer, on Titan are. So there's still a lot of outstanding questions about that, but it's a very intriguing hypothesis. So that's just a quick summary of some of the observations and results we have from Titan observations in the past year. As I said, tomorrow is a T86 flyby, and this is actually quite a close flyby. The altitude's 656 kilometers. This is a flyby on which the ion and neutral mass spectrometer is the prime instrument during closest approach, and it will actually be getting a sample profile through the ionosphere of Titan. The INMS and the radar actually usually observe quite well together. So during the closest approach period, the radar will actually be doing some synthetic aperture radar imaging of the southwestern shore of Lygia Mare. This is one of the seas at the North Pole, and one of the things that will be very interesting to look at is whether there have been any changes since the last time Lygia has been observed. I mentioned that on the shoreline of Ontario seemed to have changed between observations over the mission. We haven't yet detected any changes in the shorelines in the Northern Hemisphere, but it would be very interesting and very informative to find out if there have been changes, especially as we move into northern summer. There'll also be observations by the some of the remote sensing instruments, the imaging, the ultraviolet spectrometer, and the SIRS, the composite infrared spectrometer, as well as VIMS, which I should have listed here as well. I'm sorry. And these observations will include coverage of Adiri, which is an equatorial region, and the region where we saw a lot of changes due to rain a couple of years ago. Most of those changes have reverted in the meantime, but it's been interesting to watch the timescale over which such changes have occurred and reverted back to their original appearance. So this will give us a good view of that area. In addition, there's actually an extra day after the encounter where Cassini gets to just look at Titan and the imaging system, as well as the infrared instruments, SIRS and VIMS. We'll be watching Titan. ISS particularly likes, we like to try to get long periods of time over which to track clouds. But of course, this depends on Titan's weather cooperating. I mentioned earlier there haven't been a lot of clouds observed on Titan in the past couple of years since the big storm. We've seen a few more recently, so we'll see in a few days whether we get some clouds this time. And there's a lot more to come. You can see the penultimate slide is the Cassini mission overview again, and we're moving into a higher inclination phase. There are fewer flybys of some of the other satellites and Enceladus while we're in higher inclination because of the geometry of the orbit, but we still have many Titan flybys upcoming and are looking forward to continuing to learn more about the system. Thanks very much.
Great, TV. That was a wonderful talk. I sort of am going to take the moderator's privilege again. I noticed you said that the tomorrow's flyby is going to be at 6:56. It seems a little low. I think it's actually at 9:56 kilometers.
I pulled this. It does seem low. I pulled this off of the Cassini webpage, and I was surprised at it because we don't usually get quite that low. So 9:56 does make more sense. We should probably check the number on the Cassini webpage.
Yeah, I'm looking in Sims right now. I see none.
Oh, very good. Okay, that will be more accurate than the Cassini webpage. And
yeah,
I should have pulled it out of the flyby. In fact, I've probably got that right here.
I had a question about this the flattening, and I think there's a lot of evidence out there that there is some sort of global ocean beneath an outer shell. And you mentioned the height of the tides. So obviously, I guess, whatever shell there is obviously got to be able to flex a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Is that inconsistent with the idea that the flattening could be frozen in?
It is. It would be, yes, because you would expect that if it's able to deform on that kind of time scale, on the tidal time scale, then it would be very hard to explain the shape being frozen in. So this theory of Chacrune and Sautin helps explain that. For Iapetus, where there's very little question that it's just a solid ball of ice at this point, albeit a very mysterious solid ball of ice, having the tidal shape frozen in makes sense. But if there's a liquid layer and it can respond on and the global shape can respond on shorter time scales, it's harder to explain that way.
Do we have any other questions out there for Zibi? Okay, well, while we wait for some other questions, I was also wondering about the dunes. And essentially what I was asking myself is where the dune material is derived. Does the distribution of the dunes tell you what the dune material, how you actually get sand effectively and where it's coming from?
That is an exceedingly good question. We know from models that the sand on Titan actually has to be, in order to, you can see, based on the conditions, what the size of the particles needs to be to form dunes. And on Titan, it's basically the same as on Earth. It has to be sand-sized particles. The particles seem to be hydrocarbon-based. But how you get sand-sized particles is a very good question, especially sand-sized hydrocarbon particles. There's quite a lot of hydrocarbon material precipitating out of the atmosphere from the aerosols, but that's a very fine scale. There's also a lot of erosion of the bedrock on Titan, but the bedrock is water ice. So you either need some process that takes the aerosols, the little aerosol particulates, and cements them into sand-sized particles, conveniently enough, or you need water ice sand, which is perhaps easier to explain by erosion of the surface, that's coated with enough hydrocarbon material that it looks to the spectral, it looks spectrally like hydrocarbon material. So there's actually a pretty large outstanding question about where this material comes from. I guess another source of material would be impact cratering. There's a lot of the material will be broken up and ejected into the atmosphere and then back down onto the surface in the form of ejected blankets, which could then be eroded as well. So there are sources of this material, but it's not quite understood how, because we don't actually know the detailed composition of the material, and there are big questions about the formation. The other question is the transport. If, you know, the precipitation of aerosols is global. There's, you know, solid particulates coming out of the atmosphere at all latitudes. Erosion of the surface is global. Erosion of the surface by impact cratering is global. All of these processes are global. So there would need to be some sort of transport process, and that this has been hypothesized, of material toward the lower latitudes. And then a concentration of the material there, or it's trapped in some other, you know, in some other geologic forms that don't form dunes at higher latitudes. So there are actually quite a few outstanding questions raised by the dunes, and we know they're dunes and we know what's needed to form dunes, but how we get from the materials at hand on Titan into the dune-forming materials is a bit of a mystery.
Interesting. Thanks. Anybody else with any other questions out there?
It's about that last slide, 16.
Yep. Go ahead.
Can you tell us about that last slide,
oh, okay,
number
sorry.
16? With
I didn't hear the
Titan in the distance.
Yeah. Well, that's it's a color image acquired by Cassini last spring of Titan behind the rings, and you can see. In fact, you can kind of see a slight sliver of Titan in the middle of the rings. But this illustrates the density of the ring material that you don't see Titan. Through the rings, except in the gaps, but it's quite a visually appealing image of the rings occulting Titan, and you can see actually the haze layers. You can see kind of the blue haze layer and a hood at the lower part of the image.
But that bright region at the lower limb is not the polar vortex we've been discussing, is it?
It's not the polar vortex, but it may be the polar high latitude haze, the hood of haze. That's a higher altitude, not high latitude. It is high latitude, but high altitude haze. This polar hood that we see. So that's not edge on view of the polar vortex, but maybe an edge on view of the polar hood of high altitude haze. Forming at the South Pole. Yeah, so that's similar to, where's the slide, what BIM saw in T83 and T84, which is the same time frame, so the 22nd of May, 7th of June, this past spring. You can see a very similar feature above the limb on slide 9.
Thank you.
Okay, so if there are no more questions, I would like to thank our speakers, Professor Ingersoll and Dr. Turtle, for some really interesting material. We do not currently have the next CHARM telecon scheduled. Typically, it would be in about 3 months, but that puts us during the holiday season. So expect to hear from me sometime early next year with our next CHARM telecon and the topic and presenter are still TBD. So thank you, everyone, and we will talk later. Goodbye.
Thanks very much. Take care.